Well, we have come in our study to Romans 11, 16 and 17, and the paragraph that follows on the heels of that. It's kind of an interesting shift in content, but we'll get into that. Last week, I argued that Paul, in verse 15, was again repeating his claim that God's dealings with national Israel were contrary to the expectation, in that God's response resulted in great riches for the nations rather than great disaster for the nation, though it did result in a significant disaster for the nation shortly. The crucifixion of the Christ occurred 37 years after he came into the world, and 37 years after they crucified him, their nation was demolished. The city and the sanctuary were destroyed, and the Jews ceased to have a national identity, and that lasted until 1948. Anyway, Paul doesn't zero in on that. He zeroes in on the fact that if their rejection be the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? So he's still talking about the good that God has used Israel's obstinate, persistent resistance to bring about salvation of the Gentiles. He had defined the riches that he's talking about for the Gentiles in a summary way in verse 11 by calling it salvation, but then he expanded that summary into the next two phrases in verse 12, riches for the world and riches for the nations, riches being the basic word, and then the world and the nations being a way to characterize the, I think, the domain of Messiah's kingdom. It's going to cover the whole world. And within that domain, there will be multiple nations who are introduced to us in Matthew's record of Jesus' declaration that there's going to be a judgment of the nations, and there'll be sheep nations and goat nations. And the sheep nations will go into Messiah's kingdom and have a national identity there. But anyway, it's going to be riches for the whole world and riches for every nation that's permitted to participate in Messiah's kingdom when he comes. And this expansion is rooted in the fall of the nation of the hardened, the nation of the hardened. There's a group there that he talks about in this context where those who were chosen obtained it and the rest were the hardened. So the issue there is that the nation of Israel had come in its historical development to a condition of majority hardness, vast majority hardness. And he talks about the diminishing, or the fact that they didn't achieve their objective, which was righteousness by law, or on the other hand, status on the basis of their performance, so that in effect they could control what God did with them or to them based on their claim that they'd done everything he told them to. But the issue is the future, because he talks about the fullness of the nation, of the foreknown. We're going to get into all of this a little bit in a minute, but this is basically review. In repetition, he addresses again the casting away in terms of its consequence, which is reconciling of the world, and their receiving, instead of casting away, their receiving, which is a future event, when they are received by Messiah, and he calls that life from the dead, because Daniel chapter 12 says that after the tribulation of those days, many who are in the dust of the ground shall rise. And these are the ones that are involved in the first resurrection, and that has not to do with the resurrection of the church, which occurs earlier than that, but the first resurrection in terms of first in kind. There are about seven different resurrections recorded in the scriptures of either groups or individuals, but there are only two kinds of resurrection, one's to life and the other's to condemnation. So in Revelation 19 or 20, whichever, it says that these are those who were involved in the first resurrection, not first in time, but first in kind. Anyway, afterwards, in verse 16, he gives a reason of sorts. In my perspective from left field, he says, if the first piece of dough be holy, the lump is also, and if the root be holy, the branches are too. And you'd say, well, now where in the world did all that come from? Well, we're going to see in verses 17 and following that he's actually going to use a metaphor of the root and the tree and the branches and the breaking off of branches and the grafting in the branches and all that, because he recognizes on the basis of the reconciliation of the nations being granted by God to the nations as a result of Israel's obstinate rejection, he knows there's a significant danger in there. Because the danger is always, with human beings, the danger is always that we'll attribute some great blessing of God to some moral superiority of our own. They talk about racism in this country as if that was something new. That's just the one way of people exalting themselves over another, and they just use skin color to do it. If it weren't skin color, it'd be something else. Because that's the natural human thing, is they want to be, everybody wants to be superior to everybody that's around them. The whole issue here is Paul recognizes a significant danger, and he's going to talk about it in verse 18. Well, don't be arrogant toward the branches. If you are, remember, it's not you who supports the root, but the root supports you. And verse 20, they were broken off for their unbelief, and you stand by your faith, so don't be conceited, but fear, because if God didn't spare the natural branches, he ain't going to spare you. So there's a real significant issue here, but we're not going to get into that issue tonight. What we're going to do is look at this issue of this reason in verse 16, that if the first piece is holy, then the lump is, and if the root's holy, then the branches are. Because he's basically arguing the word that's translated first piece is actually the word for first fruit. So he's mixing a couple of metaphors. One is first fruit, and the other is dough and leaven. Because if the first fruit is holy, then the lump, which is the word that's used consistently in the New Testament, referred to the bread dough that's had yeast inserted into it. And so he's mixing some metaphors here, but he's talking about the first fruits and then the resulting lump. And if this one's holy, then this one is. And then he switches to another metaphor. If the root's holy, then the branches are. And that's the one he actually goes with in the rest of his thing. But the problem is that as soon as he says, if the root's holy, the branches are too, and if some of the branches are broken off, and so, you know, what he gives with one hand, he seems to take away with the other. How do you break off holy branches? I mean, if the root's holy and the branches are holy, why is he sticking this breaking off these branches business? And so that's where we're headed this evening. We want to understand what he's really dealing with here. So I thought, after looking at it for a good while, that it might help if we remind ourselves of the various designations that he uses in his letter in the way that he's applying these designations to the people that are involved. In 11:1, he actually starts out by talking about, has God rejected his people? So this designation, his people, is the question in 11:1, where he says, no, absolutely not. But then, in verse 11, or 11, 12, and 15, he says, in effect, they did stumble. And their rejection is the reconciliation of the world. And so you get this, did he cast them off or not? And all, you know. So, all the way through here, the issues are somewhat complicated if we don't pay attention to what he's actually dealing with. And so in 11:1, the issue is his people. And in defining that, he says, has God rejected his people? May it never be, for I too am an Israelite. So he immediately goes to Israelite as his people. And then he says, a descendant of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. So the his people is defined in chapter 11, verse 1, in terms of being an Israelite and a descendant of Abraham, which is not the order, because Israelite comes from Jacob, who's the grandson of Abraham. So if he'd have wanted to do it in chronological order, he'd have said, I am a descendant of Abraham and an Israelite and of the tribe of Benjamin. That would have been the chronology. But in verse 2, he then complicates it a little bit by saying God hasn't rejected his people whom he foreknew. And he's back to his people again. And this time he describes them as those who are foreknown. So we have to keep in mind that the big category in verses 1 and 2 is God's people, His people. And in the characterization of His people, He goes immediately to the Israelite, seed of Abraham, but He also goes down to those whom He has foreknown. And in verses 1 and 2, the issue is, has God thrust away His people? And the answer is absolutely not. But He then goes on in verse 7 and following, talking about a group of Israelites who are the hardened, and those He has cast off. Because it says, if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? And the issue of their transgression is their fall, and their failure is the failure to achieve righteousness by performance of the law. They failed on both counts. And yet, there is a fullness coming. So, in verse 2 of 11, not only does He talk about the foreknown, but then He goes immediately to this passage about Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel. Now, Israel is the issue in verse 1 as one of His people. But now, He's got Elijah talking and complaining about Israel. But there, He's talking about the northern kingdom, because Elijah was a prophet to the northern kingdom. And He says about Israel that they've killed your prophets, they've torn down your altars, and I'm alone and left, and they're seeking my life. And then God says, no, you're not by yourself. I've kept for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And in the same way, there comes to be, at this present time, a remnant. So within the northern kingdom of Israel, the vast majority are apostate. They're the hardened. But within that apostate hardness, there are 7,000 that God has kept for Himself. And that 7,000 are then, in verses 5 and 6 and following, called the remnant. And it's a remnant according to grace. And that means it's not by law. So all the way through here, we have some terminology that is shifting. We have the Israelite that Paul is in verse 1, that God has not rejected, and he's the seed of Abraham and so forth. But then we have the Israelites of the northern kingdom of Israel, and they are apostate, except for 7,000 of them. And so all of this is swirling around itself, and the issue of God keeping for Himself a group of 7,000 is a declaration of the category in verses 1 and 2, where He calls them my people. These are my people whom I've foreknown. Because to keep these 7,000 as a remnant according to grace is tied right back to chapter 9, where He talks about being foreknown. And so this whole issue of my people, the foreknown, and my people, the nation of Israel, which contains a whole great big gob of unbelieving, hardened people, you have to keep in mind that He's being very selective about how He applies that. And the conclusion that I've drawn so far is that this declaration that my people are not primarily Israel, but are rather those elected by grace within the northern kingdom of Israel, whose election is tied to the earlier issue of foreknowledge. So the big category is my people. The subcategory is my people are the ones who are foreknown, which God has not rejected. And these foreknown include these 7,000 that God has preserved for Himself out of the northern kingdom when Elijah said, there ain't nobody but me. And then in chapter 9, if you go back to the earlier context, we have a very interesting parallel here, because in chapter 9, Paul starts out the chapter in the first 5 verses talking about his kinsmen according to the flesh who are Israelites, and yet they're rejecting Christ, and he's willing to be accursed from Christ for their sake, and everything belongs to them, but they haven't embraced it. And he says in verse 6, but it's not as though the word of God has failed, for they are not all Israel who are descended from Israel. In other words, there is an elect group, and then there is a larger group. And in chapter 9, he actually defines them. He says they are children of flesh, that's the larger group, and then there are children of promise, that's the smaller group. And so in chapter 9, we have a very clear designation of two kinds of Israel. There is the nation of Israel made up of all kinds of physical seed, But within that physical seed, there is this smaller group who are physical seed, but they're also directly produced by God. Now, in that category, we have the true Israel who all have the characteristics of being the seed of Abraham, the people whom God foreknew and can't push away. That's the smaller Israel within Israel who are elected by grace. So in chapter 9, we have this issue raised, and we're going to come back to that in a minute. But in chapter 11, verse 5, he says, there has come to be a remnant. And so in that verse, he has this designation of a remnant according to the election of grace, which belong to God on the basis of grace and not works. So this again is verses 1 and 2, the my people who are foreknown, who are now the remnant according to grace and not on the basis of performance or works. And then in verse 7 of chapter 11, he says, what then? That which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained. Well, which Israel? Well, not the one Paul's a part of. He's not seeking righteousness by law. But the larger group is. He said they didn't get it. But who did get it? The chosen, the elect obtained it. The rest were the hardened. And the whole issue here is that Paul is making a sharp distinction between those whom God foreknew and elected and are called my people, and those that are not elected, and they are the nation of Israel, and they're descendants of Abraham and Israel, but they are the hardened. And then if we go back to chapter 9, the benefit of chapter 9 is that it run ahead of chapter 11, so we're supposed to have all this down, and I'm sure you do, but we're going back over it anyway. The issue is, in chapter 9, it says in verse 23 that, well, verse 22 says, what if God, being willing to demonstrate his wrath and make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? Now, vessels of wrath prepared for destruction are simply God's intention to demonstrate his wrath and power. In other words, in order to get to know God, you got to know something about everything that's true of him. And one of the things that's true of him is his wrath. And another thing that's true of him is his power. And so this wrath and power thing has to be demonstrated in some tangible way in order for finite creatures to come to grips with the characteristics of the infinite. And so, in effect, the vessels of destruction fitted for wrath, or vessels of wrath, are necessary to the educational process for those who are going to be shown mercy and have life, because their life will be tied to how well they know God, and they're going to have to understand his wrath and power as well as his mercy and all those other things. So it says in verse 23, having established the fact that God has this intention through vessels of wrath to demonstrate his wrath and power, but it says in verse 23, he also did it in order that he might make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. So we have these two categories, vessels of wrath and vessels of mercy. But then he says in verse 24, and here's the key, even us whom he also called, that is, vessels of mercy whom God called, but then he says this, not only from among the Jews, but also from among the Gentiles. And then he quotes Hosea, I will call those who were not my people, my people. And her who was not beloved, I'll call beloved. And it shall be in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of the living God. Now that's the basis for the statement in chapter 11, verse 1. Where it says, has God cast off his people? Well, Paul said in chapter 9, his people includes two groups, not Jews only, but also non-Jews. So in chapter 11, we have this reality that Paul is dealing with God's treatment of that category called my people, and then that other category called the hardened. And just because the focus is on Israel in the context, is not a big deal, because in the first century, my people were found in Israel primarily. Now, there may have been a few outside of Israel that were called and chosen and shown mercy and became vessels of mercy, through the efforts of some faithful Jews, because Jesus said, you guys, you go all around the world trying to make proselytes. So they had an evangelistic program of making the God of Israel known. And in the history that's recorded in the Old Testament, you all run regularly into Gentiles who come to faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, like Rahab and some of those. So the point is, in the first century, if you were going to talk about God's people, you'd probably be talking about Jews. Most everybody's mind would run straight to that, because until the day of Pentecost, until this new program started where you're going to be my witnesses unto the uttermost parts of the earth, until that happened, God had focused on the offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. And his dealings with Israel over 1,500 years were primarily on Israel. Now, there were events like Jonah going to Nineveh. And there was a generation of Ninevites who apparently believed the truth, and they're going to stand in judgment against the generation of the first century, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. According to John the Baptizer, if you repent, God will forgive you. So their repentance brought them into a relationship with God. But it only lasted a little while, because within 120 years they were wiping out the northern kingdom. But my point is, there were Gentiles periodically, but the big picture thing was, my people equaled at least some people within Israel. And that's the norm for the first century. But Paul's argument in Romans is that this my people being Jewish is passing off the scene. There is a new program in the works now where God is going to call from among the nations people by grace. And they're going to become my people, according to the prophecy of Hosea. And it will be said to them who were not my people that you are my people. So this my people category, and this is the heart of Romans 11 in the first century setting, because Paul got into all kinds of conflict with the Jews over the fact that he was preaching that the Gentiles could have an equal standing in the sight of God as the Jews. And they would just go into a rage over that. They didn't want to have any competitors for God's special focus of attention. They were fixated on being superior to everybody else on the planet because God had chosen them. Even though Moses told them, God says, don't you think I chose you because you were special in terms of good? Because you're not. You're stiff-necked and hard-hearted people. In spite of the fact that God told them that, they still had this sense of superiority over all other nations, because we're the only ones that have a relationship with the true God, and we're a light to the Gentiles, and on and on and on and on. That's Romans 2. Paul says, if all that's true, how come the nations blaspheme your God because of your behavior? But anyway, the my people category in chapter 11 includes Paul's ministry as an apostle to the Gentiles. He said in verse 13, I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles. I am magnifying my ministry as an apostle to Gentiles. God has opened the door of reconciliation to Gentiles. Now you are part of the my people of God. God says of you, you are my people. But you're not Jews, and you're not descendants of Abraham, and you're not descendants of Israel. But you're still God's people. And that's the whole point. Because of the national rejection of Messiah, the people of God never rejected Jesus. They embraced him as soon as they came to know who he was, and they believed in him. And there were several thousands within the nation of Israel when Jesus was on the planet that embraced him as the Messiah. And afterwards, through the preaching of Peter as the apostle of the circumcision, there were lots and lots of Jews who believed that Jesus was their Christ. Those were the people of God who happened to be also the offspring of Israel and Abraham. But Paul said they didn't recognize the fact that because of the national obstinance and the murder of their Christ as a nation, God had turned his attention to the nations. And now there are a whole bunch of people from among the Gentile nations who are my people, God says. So when he says God can't cast off my people or his people, he's talking about the foreknown elect from Jew or Gentile. And that helps in our understanding of this branches business. So when we go in verse 16, if the first fruit's holy, then the consequent lump is also. And basically, if we try to understand the metaphor instead of the way the New American Standard translators translate it, because they stick the word first fruits with the lump of dough. So they're trying to keep the metaphor stuck with yeast introduced into dough, and if the first part is holy, then the lump will be too. But I really don't think that's what's going on. I really think that the word first fruit in verse 16 is translated first piece. It's not a piece of dough. And the lump's not dough. He's talking about the first fruits holy, and then the whole crop that comes after the first fruits is holy too. And of course, we've already run into that metaphor in our interaction with this context when I talked about the fact that John the Baptist introduced Jesus as standing on the threshing floor with his fan in his hand, and he's going to separate the chaff from the wheat, and he's going to burn the chaff with fire, and he's going to put the wheat in a barn. Well, that's a prophecy John induced Jesus by, and here we have that same metaphor being introduced here with the notion that the first parts of the crop, if they're holy, then the whole crop will be down line. And then he turns immediately and goes to a different metaphor. He says, if the root's holy, then the branches are. Well, he's talking here about a tree. If the root of the tree is holy, then the tree as it grows is going to be producing branches, and those branches are, in effect, the latter development. Just like the first fruit of the grain is like the root, and the whole harvest is like the branches, if you want to compare the two metaphors. But then immediately he goes into this problem that's introduced in verse 17 about breaking some of the branches off. So we have this challenge before us. How can you break off a holy branch? Well, let's think about it along this line. The first thing that we need to be clear on, because he talks about being a descendant of Abraham in verse 1. Abraham was given promise as the method of the inheritance. That's what's going on in verse 7 when he says, Israel was seeking for the inheritance, but they were seeking it on the basis of their performance of divine command so that they could say, I qualified myself, I deserve a part of the inheritance. And Paul's argument is, you go to God with that kind of argument, he'll throw you out faster than you can imagine, because promise is the method of the inheritance, not performance. And it's a really good thing, because the guy who got the promise was the one who lied to the Pharaoh about his wife's identity as his sister. And, that performance was pathetic. So it's not on the basis of performance, it's on the basis of promise. But he was given promise as a method of the inheritance. And Isaac was the first fruit of that promise. He was the first kid born because God had promised somebody a seed when the somebody's wife was barren. Now, as a first fruit, he in a sense is right in between two things. One of them is Genesis 3, where God tells the serpent, and Eve overhears, that Eve's seed is going to bruise the head of the serpent. So you have the first promise issue way back in Genesis 3 about Christ coming as the seed of the woman, who will undo the damage that the deceiver has done there in the garden, and he's going to destroy him in the process, bruise his head in the process. Well, that promise was given, but it took 4,000 years before Jesus came, and Isaac was in this line, but he was the first son of promise as somebody specifically produced by God in the face of insurmountable obstacle. Sarah's barren womb had been barren for the whole time of her marriage, and Abraham was of an age, Paul says, where his body was as good as dead. And so God waited to produce this son he promised so that it would be recognized that when he promises, that means you believe him, and then he'll do what he promised. And it even says in Hebrews 11 that Isaac was conceived when Sarah believed. She received the strength to conceive by faith. So it took her not the whole 90 years, because she was a kid for a long time, not married for part of the time, but during her married life and her barrenness, there were all kinds of tensions, because every woman in that day wanted to have children for her husband. And there were just problems. But God comes along when Sarah's 65 and Abraham's 75 and says, I'm going to give you a seed. You're going to have a son. Well, 25 years rolled by. No son. So finally, you get this son of promise. Well, Isaac is that son of promise, but he's pointing back to Genesis 3 where the original son was promised. And then he's also pointing forward to Galatians 3:16, where Paul says that the seed was not as of many, but as one. That is Christ. So Isaac is the first son of promise, but he's not the final fulfillment of the son of promise concept, because Jesus is the son of promise. And I'll probably mention this again, but in Romans 15:12, Jesus actually is identified as the root in whom the Gentiles will trust. So Genesis 11 introduces this root and branches thing, and technically the root is Jesus. He's the son of promise. So Abraham is given promise as a method of inheritance. Isaac was the first, and then Jacob was changed to Israel as a name, was the beginning of the following lump, or the harvest that is coming. Isaac was the first fruit, and Jacob's 12 sons and all of their children afterwards were the harvest. They were the full crop. Well, in the full crop, according to the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, the full crop is going to include wheat and tares, and the wheat are going to be separated from the tares at the end, so that there's not an uprooting of some of the wheat and the angelic uprooting of the tares. And then you have this winnowing thing on the threshing floor, so that not only are the tares out of the way, but now the chaff is blown away. And now you just have the final harvest. That's the true lump. It's the final state of things. And that's all gathered into the garner, into the barn. Prophetically, the whole picture runs where God starts the nation with a son of promise, Isaac. He develops the nation through Israel, the man named Jacob, whose name was changed. He has 12 sons, and that's the foundation for the development of the nation. But of those 12 sons, there are many children of the flesh, Romans 9, children of the flesh. But within the children of the flesh, there are also children of promise. God's producing people who believe him. And so the historical development goes long and long and long. And finally, in the first century, when Jesus actually comes, the nation has reverted to the kind of apostasy that Israel entered into and the Assyrians carried them away. And then Judah entered into it and the Babylonians carried them away. And so you have this apostasy thing where there's a remnant. And that's where Isaiah says, even if the seed of Israel are like the sand of the seashore, it is the remnant that will be saved. So you have this massive growth in numerical numbers of offspring of Israel. But a whole bunch of them are hardened. And so down you come to the end of the prophetic picture when Michael stands up and there's a tribulation like it's never been seen. And in the tribulation period that's prophesied, a whole host of Israelites who are hardened are going to be winnowed out of Israel. And they'll be destroyed. And then, Paul says in Romans 11, a little bit later on, then all Israel will be saved. The final harvest will be there in that generation. So, as an issue of how this is all working out, in terms of a mixture, the lump can't be considered holy except as that lump is gradually winnowed out, reduced to the called from among the Jews by the purging judgments of God at the end, and that will bring Christ's kingdom to pass. But Paul doesn't camp on that first fruit lump analogy. And instead, he turns to the root and branches analogy, where Abraham apparently is the root because he's the father of all those who believe. He's the root. But he produced some branches that had to be removed before the tree could be considered holy, holy. That's W-H-O-L-L-Y and then H-O-L-Y, completely holy. The branches that sprang out of Abraham. Abraham had more sons than Isaac. Isaac was the son of promise, but he had Ishmael by a woman that wasn't Abraham's wife. And then he had six sons under Keturah, and they're not included. So Abraham as the root is producing some branches, but not all of them are going to be there after the whole process of breaking some out and grafting some in and all that kind of thing. So when he says, if the root's holy, the branches are also, he is qualifying that by telling us in verse 17 that there's going to be a pruning process where branches that were grown out of the efforts of the flesh, they're children of the flesh, they're going to be broken off because of their unbelief. So they are at first holy, like the root, because Isaac was a child of promise and he was holy like his father Abraham as the root. But Ishmael was born before him, and the sons of Keturah were born after him, and they're not in that mix. So they're branches of Abraham in the sense of him being a human root, but they're not children of promise. And then he goes on and describes the process of pruning and grafting in verse 17. Some of the branches are broken off, and you, coming out of a wild olive, were grafted in among them and became partaker with them of the rich root. Now, don't be arrogant, because the reason that they were broken off, according to verse 19, or verse 20, is that they would not believe. They were broken off before their unbelief. And you stand by faith. But your standing by faith has to be genuine, and you have to maintain that issue of faith and not go into arrogance, because he said if he didn't preserve the natural branches, he's certainly not going to preserve any grafted in arrogant branch. That's Paul's argument. So in terms of the root and the branches, the whole issue of the holiness thing, if the root's holy, the branches are. If the first fruit's holy, then the harvest is. All of that assumes a beginning and an ending, but a complicated middle, where the complicated middle has both parts of harvest that are not part of it, like chaff and tares, and parts of branches that are not part of the tree. They're there, but they get broken out because they're not believing. So they're cast aside. And the whole issue of this holiness is by faith, verse 20. They stand by faith. So the conclusions that I draw is, Paul is not writing about Israel. He's writing about the people of God that are predominantly Israel early in the first century, but afterward the gospel goes to the nations, then it's a mixture of Israelites and Gentiles, Jewish and Gentiles, but they're the people of God. That's the real issue. And he defines his root in chapter 15, verse 12, as Christ, the root in whom the Gentiles will trust. He doesn't say it, but he's also the root in which the Jews trust, the saved Jews. So, there's a time in history when the first root was holy, Abraham the believer, justified by faith, and a time of history that flowed along when the tree produced by the root became a mixture of holy branches made so by faith and unholy branches made so by determined opposition to faith in favor of works. And a future time when all of this is going to come to its final resolution and all the unbelieving will be eliminated. And my people will enter into Messiah's kingdom, but the my people are both Jews and Gentiles. That's the real big picture that's involved in this grand plan that Paul's trying to explain. You're going to have wild branches grafted in because they believe the gospel. And you're going to have natural branches broken out because they are a disobedient and argumentative group, according to chapter 10, verse the last verse in the chapter. So it's kind of complicated, and the complications arise partly because we're 2,000 years removed from the setting, but also partly because Paul shifts his terminology back and forth, and we have to stay with him and what he means. And when he says in chapter 11, verse 1, that God didn't cast off his people, that identifies the major category, which he has already identified in chapter 9 as not from us Jews only, but also from the nations. He called them my people. And about those nations who had not been his people, it says, in the place where they said, you're not my people, there they will be called my people.